Hello there. Today is Friday, November the 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump continues to meet with advisors and work on building a staff. The current president is in Germany urging Trump to stand up to Russia.
That the president-elect also is willing to stand up to Russia where they are deviating.
We will also have more on what to expect in terms of national security. Also ahead, the boxing movie about an amazing comeback. It's all on today's International Edition. With 2 months to go until Donald Trump's inauguration as the 45th president of the United States, the process of building a new government continues as supporters, critics, and political analysts debate exactly how much of a public mandate he has to act once he's in office. In Washington, Vice President-elect Mike Pence huddled with Republican leaders in Congress and then met with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer, the newly elected leader of the Senate Democrats. Pence is seeking to convey respect as Democrats prepare for Republican rule of both chambers and the White House for the first time in a decade.
We're beginning to discuss areas that we might move forward on together. And I think that's what the American people want us to do. Is find ways to revive our economy, improve American lives, enhance the security of this nation. And I'm grateful to begin those discussions on behalf of the president-elect with you today.
Well, joining us now for more on all the happenings on Capitol Hill, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Lots going on, Catherine.
Absolutely. This week, back on Capitol Hill, the first week for House Republicans after that surprising election, was a complete turnaround in many ways. You know, Paul Ryan had actually expected to be knocked out of the Speaker of the House position when all of the Republicans came back, and he actually returned triumphant and ready to implement his Better Way agenda along with the president-elect.
Right. Anything else that you got from members on the Hill? Obviously, Republicans are pretty happy.
Well, I think the Pence visit on Thursday was very important, coming as it did after almost a full week of the Trump transition team having these bad stories roll out about infighting, about reorgs, all of these different criticisms about his appointment of Steve Bannon, who is with the far right-leaning Breitbart News and has drawn a great deal of criticism for some of his beliefs. You know, to have Pence there, a former congressman, show up on his home turf, talk about the agenda, talk about the positive ways that the administration and House Republicans were going to work together, seemed to reassure a lot of the House members that I spoke with.
Okay, and then on the other side of the aisle, you had Bernie Sanders holding a rally in Washington.
That's right. So everyone...
And you've been busy yourself dealing with all of this stuff going on in Washington.
That's right. It's been a busy week here. Seems like everyone is processing what happened in this key election that's
right.
Really changed the country. And certainly for a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters, the sense was that those changes are still coming, that mm-hmm. they need to look forward, they need to marshal their resources. There are still so many important issues from their point of view to fight for: income inequality, TPP, climate change. All of those things, those are battles that still need to be fought. And they still see Bernie Sanders as their leader. And that certainly hasn't changed since he was elected to a new Senate leadership post.
And what exactly did he tell folks?
Well, he started out by reminding his supporters that Donald Trump had lost the popular vote by more than 2 million votes. And he reminded supporters that Donald Trump doesn't have the monopoly on this idea that he's against the establishment. You know, Bernie Sanders and his supporters are very anti-establishment as well. They've also talked about how the system is set up against poor people. They want to break up Wall Street. They want to break up the big banks so that there's a little bit more freedom in this country. So he had this very powerful line at the end where he said, Donald Trump is not against the establishment. We are, and that's how we move forward here. So a very rousing moment on Capitol Hill, even as Mike Pence was inside meeting with Republicans.
All right. We appreciate it. VOA congressional correspondent, I should say, Catherine Gibson. Turning now to social media with our own G. Abby Lee. G, what's happening?
Hi, Lori. Let's talk politics.
Oh, that's new.
The House Republicans posted a photo on Thursday with a caption, Unified. The picture was taken after Vice President-elect Mike Pence was welcomed by House Speaker Paul Ryan. A political writer shared the photo from the House GOP Twitter account, and she wrote, "This is really cute. It definitely showed unity among the party, with people showing the thumbs-up sign that President-elect Donald Trump enjoys doing." But the majority of Twitter users pointed out the one glaring fact that most of the people in that photo were middle-aged white men. One user replied, "What is diversity? Who are millennials?" Another person wrote, "This is like a Where is Waldo, where Waldo is a black man."
Wow.
Nowhere to be found.
Wow. Well, you told me earlier there's another photo that's trending on social media. What is that?
So, conservative political commentator Glenn Beck. He was recently seen in a not-so-conservative getup, and it didn't take long for it to become a meme.
Really?
He was wearing an off-white fedora, yellow-tinted shades, a scarf, and some type of denim jacket. And it looks like something a hipster in his 30s would wear. And some Twitter users quipped, is this what he thinks liberals look like?
That's funny. Okay. So speaking of liberals and Democrats, what's happening there? What's the talk on the Democratic side?
As you know, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made her first public address since the election Wednesday night, and people are still talking about it online. Clinton supporters, especially her female supporters, are talking about her appearance on Twitter. One such user tweeted, "Hillary Clinton showed tonight yet again that she will just keep going no matter how devastating the setback." Surprisingly, there weren't that many critical remarks about the address from Trump supporters, at least on social media. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her, by the way, at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Nearly 200 nations say make climate change the highest political commitment. Accused New York City bomber pleads not guilty. Twitter CEO apologizes for allowing white supremacist ads. And U.S. to prepare for an arms embargo on South Sudan. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, President Barack Obama brought his message of America's enduring unity and cooperation to the heart of Europe Thursday, stressing to Germans and all Europeans that the United States will continue to engage with the world. But once again, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump overshadowed much of the conversation. Speaking at a joint news conference with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Obama was asked to comment on how U.S.-Russian relations might change under the Trump administration. He said he's always viewed Russia as a nation in the United States should work with when it can.
Finding areas where we can cooperate with Russia, where our values and interests align. But that the president-elect also is willing to stand up to Russia where they are deviating from our values and international norms.
As President-elect Trump continues to work on who his team will be, many of the people he'll enlist will deal with pressing national security issues. Trump on Thursday did offer former military intelligence chief Michael Flynn the job of national security advisor as he began to build a national security team. Well, the move came as Trump made his most direct foray into foreign policy since the election, meeting with Japan's prime minister. Shinzo Abe is the first world leader to meet with Trump after he won the presidential election. The two met at Trump Tower in New York. And of the talks, Abe called the talks cordial. But during the campaign, Trump said things regarding how he'll deal with terrorism and national security, such as banning Muslims from entering the country, things that have raised concerns for some. Joining me now, Jamil Jaffer, professor and director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at George Mason University School of Law. Thanks for being with us. How literally should the world take some of the things he has said during the campaign regarding national security?
You know, Lori, on the campaign trail, certainly Donald Trump, as did Hillary Clinton, talked really tough on terrorism and the need to deal with ISIS. And they had sort of very different prescriptions for it. Trump's prescriptions were very strong. I think it elicited a lot of strong reactions from people in the national security community. But, you know, that strong talk, now that he's in the position of governing, can actually be translated into very real action. I think that you could see very simple things that could be done, things that he could do on his own first, and then some he could do with Congress. So, for example, on his own, he could lift some of the restrictions that are currently in place on our offensive counterterrorism operation, right? So today, the Obama administration's policy, not required by international law, but policy, is to look for a near certainty of no collateral damage and a near certainty of that the target is valid, right? And so there's a little more flexibility in international law when you're fighting a war, which this certainly is. And the president could use that space. The president-elect could use that space, international law, to more aggressively pursue terrorist targets. One of the other things we did was President Obama, in the aftermath of the Snowden disclosures, voluntarily limited foreign intelligence collection overseas, providing certain American-like benefits, protections that usually apply to Americans here in the United States, to foreigners located overseas in a document called PPD 28.
Mm-hmm.
You could see President-elect Trump considering whether he removes some of those restrictions and re-enables some of that collection. On the congressional side, he can work with Congress to reauthorize the most valuable intelligence collection program we have, Section 702. And there's a variety of things, you know, both things he can do on his own as well as things he can do with Congress.
How difficult will it be for him to really act upon some of the things that he has said that he would do, like potentially screening individuals coming from specific parts of the world, potentially Muslim countries?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we have a lot of screening programs in place for refugees, for example, from the Syrian conflict. We have strong screening programs in place. Certainly there are things, you know, President Trump said during the campaign that he would engage in extreme vetting. And, you know, the query whether what the vetting we do today is extreme, but certainly you could see an increase in that vetting. And so, you know, you could make it tougher, you could slow it down. That's been suggested at times, and it's, you know, it's not crazy. It would certainly limit the flow of refugees and exacerbate the refugee problem, which is a problem not only for the countries immediately in the region, mm-hmm. but for our allies in Europe.
Right.
So that's going to be a challenge, and he'll have to find a way to navigate that. You know, look, the reality is that it's the heat of the political campaign trail is one thing. The fact of governing is a very different thing. And I think we'll know a lot more about how President-elect Trump intends to govern by the people he puts around him, the people he nominates, and if the Senate confirms them, are confirmed to positions of senior responsibility in national security, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Homeland Security, the National Security Advisor, not Senate confirmed, of course. So those will make a big difference. And so I think we still have a lot to see about that. And I do think you've seen a change in his tone now since he's been elected president. Now, of course, you know, the tone during the campaign was fairly strong and extreme, some would say. But during in the aftermath of the campaign, you've seen definitely moderation coming from the president's own words. And we'll see what happens with his appointments and the like.
Jamil Jaffer, professor and director of Homeland and National Security Law at George Mason University School of Law. Thanks for being with us. Well, one of Donald Trump's picks to be a senior advisor is a man named Steve Bannon. He's been a controversial figure who's been accused of anti-Semitism and white nationalism. A number of groups, including the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Organization, have called on Trump to rescind his decision to bring Bannon into the administration. International Edition's Michael Lippin talked to Morton Klein, national president of the Zionist Organization of America, who has a different perspective.
I think the Anti-Defamation League and others, Jewish liberals, have falsely and maliciously tried to assassinate the character of Stephen Bannon. Stephen Bannon is the opposite of an anti-Semite, as they've charged. He's a lover of Israel and the Jewish people. anti-Semites don't hire, as he has, religious Jews who wear yarmulkes all day. An anti-Semite wouldn't be able to stand looking at them. And he's had at least two people such that he's hired. When we've asked him to help us in fighting campus anti-Semitism at City College, for example, he had his reporters repeatedly calling City College and calling the governor's Cuomo's office, urging and demanding them to do something about this campus anti-Semitism. On his website, he has constant articles against BDS, against Israel, about campus anti-Semitism, about swastikas in New York schools, and he interviews the Jewish students there with sympathy and with chagrin. And when he writes about Israel, Israel is always praised and supported, and the Palestinian Authority is exposed as an anti-peace, pro-terror regime that promotes hatred and violence against Jews in their schools, in their media, in their speeches, in their sermons. He condemns them for naming schools, streets, and sports teams after Jew-killing terrorists. And so this whole campaign against him is clearly not about anti-Semitism. This campaign is about Republican versus Democrat. They're trying to harm him because he's a Republican and reduce the credibility of Trump. And I say that because Keith Ellison is high up on the list to become head of the DNC, Democrat National Committee. He has made vicious anti-Israel, anti-Semitic statements. He worked with Louis Farrakhan for 2 years, raising funds for him. He's spoken at the horrific anti-Israel Muslim conferences, people who are close to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. He's called Israel an apartheid state. And I can go on, and you didn't hear one word about any of these ADL or any of these groups criticizing Keith Ellison because he's a liberal Democrat.
I do have to ask about one issue that the ADL and many other liberal Jews have raised, which is the Breitbart news site that Steve Bannon used to lead, and the fact that it has featured articles that are perceived as promoting white nationalism, and that the idea of white nationalism or supremacy is something that is contrary to the values of those American Jews. So how do you feel about that criticism that they have?
Look, I'm not sure exactly what white nationalism is. I mean, if it's people who have hatred toward non-whites, I deplore it. So Bannon has decided to allow these controversial, sometimes really awful articles to be on his site. He says, as a way to expose their lunacy and their absurdity. And in fact, he said that this has caused a meltdown in support for these people because people realize when reading about them what lunatics they are. Now, one can argue reasonably that he should not allow those people on the site, that it gives them visibility they shouldn't have, and that's a legitimate argument. If they were arguing that, I would not criticize that position, although there's the other side that Bannon takes, which says that he's exposing how ridiculous they are and actually hurting them. And he has his own reporters writing about them and condemning them.
That's Morton Klein, national president of the Zionist Organization of America. Well, a new report released Thursday by the U.S. Surgeon General is focusing on America's troubling addiction problem. The numbers in the new report facing addiction in America are stark. In 2015, over 27 million Americans used illicit drugs or misused prescription drugs. And over 66 million reported binge drinking in the past month. But the report isn't about the problem. It's about facing the problem. It's urging the nation as a whole to move forward to solve it. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on the effects of addiction in children, often the most vulnerable and the victims we know the least about.
Vicodin and OxyContin are the brand names of hydrocodone and oxycodone, powerful painkillers that are contributing to widespread drug addiction, especially in the U.S. These drugs and others contain opioids or narcotics, and while doctors often prescribe these drugs to help control chronic pain, they can lead to addiction. In the United States, sales of prescription opioids have quadrupled over the past 20 years.
The opioid epidemic has grown exponentially. It really began in the mid-1990s when physicians were encouraged to do a better job of treating chronic pain. In 2014, there were approximately 19,000 deaths that were attributed to opioid medications.
Prince's death last June was from an accidental overdose of an opioid drug. The Centers for Disease Control says in the U.S., 48 people die every day from opioid overdoses. A new study shows that in a 16-year period, more than 13,000 children and teenagers were hospitalized for opioid poisoning.
We found that the rates of hospitalizations for opioid poisonings doubled during 1997 to 2012. We also found that the highest number of hospitalizations were among teenagers, ages 15 through 19. The highest rates of increase in hospitalizations were among our youngest population, which was 1 to 4-year-old children.
The researchers say the way these drugs are prescribed, disposed of, and packaged needs to change. Accidental ingestion by infants is especially troubling.
Our national conversation has focused on how to improve the treatment and prevention of opioid misuse and abuse. But we also hope that this conversation focuses on how to safeguard children from this epidemic.
The study was published in JAMA Pediatrics. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film starring Miles Teller and Aaron Eckert, Bleed for This, tells the inspiring true story of boxer Vinny Pazina, who overcame a broken neck to win a world title. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film.
Miles Teller and Vinny Pazienza share a brotherhood neither one wanted. They were both in near-fatal car accidents. In Teller's case, he was in a crash 1 year before a good friend was killed in a car wreck. For Pazienza, a 1991 crash broke his neck and nearly ended his boxing career. Remarkably, the fighter came back from the injury, including training in a metal rig called a halo that was drilled into his skull, and was able to box again, winning the super middleweight title. Bleed for This tells the story of that comeback. Teller, best known for Whiplash and the Divergent movie series, trained with boxing trainer Daryl Foster, who trained fighters like Sugar Ray Leonard and helped Will Smith become Muhammad Ali for 2001's Ali. Teller says he thinks the film does Pazienza justice.
It was about an 8-month kind of physical test for me. I lost 20 pounds, got down to like 6% body fat. And you know, to me, that was just to have the look of the guy. And then you got to learn how to box. And you know, I thought we made like a really beautiful film. And we did it in 24 days, really tight shoot. But it was just such a, I don't know, it just felt so authentic, and I know Vinny had just a beautiful response to the film, and that means everything.
Aaron Eckert plays Pazienza's trainer, Kevin Rooney. He says Bleed for This shows the special trust that boxers have with the people in their corners.
It's a sacred bond, total trust. It's family. You know, it's interesting when you see boxers, young boxers especially, come into the game. They always have their father, they always have their family and brothers and everything, and so that continues all the way through the fight game.
Miles Teller says that Pazienza was a larger-than-life character, and his comeback is the stuff of legend.
Vinny was known as much for his personality as he was for, you know, his wins and losses. Although he did have 50 wins and 5 world championships, and fought, you know, a ton of guys. He was a showman. He loved Muhammad Ali. That's why he, you know, kind of wanted to get into boxing and knew how to sell a fight. And he just had a certain, like you said, a charisma. He was an entertaining guy, and you just, you know, you do your homework and you try and play him as truthfully as possible.
Director Ben Younger says the film and Pazienza's comeback from injury inspired him and has inspired audiences.
I think that boxing is sort of this outsized but accessible parable for the challenges that any of us face. This one takes it to the next level because of Vinny's comeback and the injury But the feeling people seem to get when they leave the theater, and it's what he did for me, honestly, on a personal level, which was you sort of reevaluate the issues you have in your life, the conflicts, the challenges that seem insurmountable. You see what this guy did, and everything just seems like doable.
Vinny Pazienza finished his career with 50 wins and 10 losses. He scored 18 of those wins and had 5 losses after his comeback from a broken neck. Bleed for This is distributed by Open Road Films and is rated R for language, sexuality, and car accident images. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that's going to do it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Mark Ferguson. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 weeks into the military offensive to liberate Mosul from its ISIL occupiers, the combined Iraqi and Kurdish forces have gained a toehold on the outskirts of the city and are pushing in. As they advance, they meet groups of civilians making their way out of the city and away from the fighting, away from brutal ISIL fighters who booby-trap the city and are more likely to shoot at civilians than to aim at opposing troops. But for every civilian fleeing the city, the invading forces encounter countless more who remain hunkered down in their homes. Indeed, conditions within the city are dire, with acute shortages of food, medicines, and daily necessities. So delivery of humanitarian aid and care for Mosul's denizens is an important part of the operation. Because this operation has been long in planning, aid workers had pre-positioned their supplies to ease delivery. We've been actively working with our partners on the ground, that's the UN and the international NGOs, to stand ready to provide emergency shelter, food, water, sanitation, and hygiene services, as well as health support. We're trying to stay ahead of the crisis, which we've been able to do, said a senior administration official during a teleconference. There have been about 3.2 million people displaced from their homes since 2014, and 10 million people in need of assistance. That equates to somewhere around one-third of the Iraqi total population. And the United States has been there supporting the Iraqi people with more than $1.1 billion in humanitarian aid since 2014. Over the summer, we've helped the international community secure pledges for $2 billion as it relates to the Mosul operation, the official said. Aid workers have pre-positioned enough food supplies for about 1.25 million people and have enough in the pipeline and ready for delivery to feed 2.3 million. They are also set to deliver shelter, water, sanitation, health care, and protection. So far, about 34,000 civilians have fled the city of Mosul since the fighting began over 3 weeks ago. But the battle for Mosul has barely begun, and aid workers are ready to deliver supplies to the entire city if necessary.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.